It is now my great pleasure to introduce, to share their experience, strength, and hope from Los Angeles, California, Jack.
My name is Rob R. I'm a Christian meth addict. Hi, it's good to be here tonight. You know, the beautiful thing about recovery and sobriety is that the friends that you make when you first come in are the friends that you keep as long as I'm sober. And Jack is a perfect example. When I came into recovery in 2005, Jack was one of the first people I met in 2007, and we worked together on the Public Information and Outreach Committee and created the first and only two public service announcements that are currently on the PSA. This is because of him. He is such a wonderful man. He has helped me maintain my sobriety throughout the years, and he has such a wonderful story about his journey from, like, where you came from in that 750 BMW to where you're at today. So I'm really excited for you guys to hear his story tonight.
Thank you. I love you. Thank you. I love you.
I don't have that BMW 750 anymore, but... good evening, everybody. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. I am a crystal meth addict. My pronouns are he, him, his. And I'm really excited to be here tonight. I was nervous. Thank you, guys. You know, whenever you come into a room and there's a bunch of people that you don't know, and you just wonder, am I going to fit in? And, you know, and I heard y'all being rowdy as shit earlier. Oh, these are my people. So it's nice to be here. So, as Rob said, we've been around for a long time. I'm going to talk a little bit about AA, and I'm going to talk a little bit about CMA, because when I got sober, CMA didn't exist. And so we're going to talk a little bit about how that goes through. So, I am from Florida originally, and in that space, I was born into a Methodist minister father and a school teacher mother. And, you know, when you're in a preacher's family, there's a certain set of rules for you, and then society has a whole bunch of other rules. So when I grew up, I was expected to be perfect. I was expected to follow the rules. I was expected to do everything. And I kind of embraced that. My sister was the wild child. She was older than I was. And she broke all the rules. And so I had to be the good boy, the best little boy. And I strived really hard to do that. But what it really came down to, I found out later in therapy, was that I just wanted you to like me. But I thought if you ever got to know me, you would never like me. So I became the me that I thought I had to be in order to have you like me. The short version of that is I'd like to say I had a confused childhood because I was both a football player and a cheerleader. And it was all about the outfits. But, you know, if you ask anybody that I grew up with, they would all have a different version of who I was, you know. And a lot of that had to do with not feeling good about how I felt on the inside. You know, setting up that circular mindfuck of, you know, I'll be who you want me to be because I really want you to like me, but because I've never been my authentic self, then you never get to know me. So it really is kind of like not a very good strategy, but it worked for a really long time. You know, I went through life trying to be all the things everybody else expected of me and then put on top of that perfectionism. And I think the first sign that I might have been someone who tried to get outside themselves was when I was a small child and 3 years old. I was kind of crawling around on the floor. And in Florida, they have these things called roach pills, and they put them out to get rid of the roaches, because even the nice houses have roaches in Florida. Apparently, I was left unattended in the kitchen for a few minutes. And when my parents came back in, they were horrified, because I had white powder all around my nose. So drug-seeking behavior started very early on in life. They had to take me to the hospital, and I had to have my stomach pumped, and, you know, it was like, but I didn't ever do that again, but I did find that white powder, you know, later. So, like I said, growing up, we were always trying to be the person everybody else wanted us to be. And, you know, one of the things I learned very early was about how to keep secrets, because, you know, that Methodist minister father had a secret. You know, he liked men. And so that Methodist minister father got busted in a park by a male vice officer in Jacksonville, Florida. Might as well be South Georgia. The newspaper reported it the next day in a big headline with his name, and I'm a junior, so it was my name on the paper too. So in that moment, my dad lost his integrity, he lost his job, he lost his wife, he lost his family, we lost our place to live, and we lost our livelihood. And so I learned very early on that, you know, if I were actually being my true and authentic self, which I really wanted to be, there might have been consequences. So I pushed all that stuff down. So going through life trying to be perfect on the outside, holding a secret on the inside, creates this dynamic tension inside. I probably needed a drink very early in life, but I was afraid because, see, if I drank, I'd be relaxed, and then I might be myself. There's no way to win in this whole thing. So that pressure built up and built up and built up. You know, I went through high school. I did all the things that I said. But the very first time I ever had a drink, it was in the 70s. I was born in 61. It was in the 70s. There was a disco called Trader Charlie's on top of the Holiday Inn in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. Disco was the theme, and I was sneaking out the window to go dancing with my friends, had fake IDs, all the stuff you do. And, you know, while I was there, there was an older woman. I think she was 24. And her name was Nancy, and Nancy was the manager of Trader Charlie's. And she heard I was a virgin, and she was going to get me drunk. She was going to get me laid. So Nancy started the night off by buying me slow gin fizzes. It was the 70s. I mean, it was nasty, but that's what we drank back then. You know, Bacardi had started to come out. White Russians were being invented. You know, Kahlua and Cream had just started. We're talking about the dates, you know, that I was young. And so she was going to show me this trick. She wanted to show me that she could tie a cherry stem in a knot with her tongue. Now, I thought that was a very interesting skill set. Not for the same reason she did, but, you know. I'll tell you, at the end of the night, I had been giving drinks all night long. I was very drunk. I did learn how to, and I still can, tie a cherry stem in a knot with my tongue. I went home that night. I did not lose my virginity, but you know what I did do? I threw up like a rainbird sprinkler all over everything. Now, a normal person would go through and say, oh, maybe I shouldn't drink. An alcoholic said, maybe I should pick clear liquor. It doesn't stain as much. And so I stopped my relationship with slow gin fizzes, and I started my relationship with vodka and tequila. And that became the dance that I did for a number of years, but I had to control it. You know, I couldn't drink through high school because if I got drunk, I might, you know, when I was in that locker room, I might do something stupid. You know, and so I was always on the edge. I was always trying to figure out how to control my drinking out of fear. And a few years go by, and, you know, it was 1986, and I was in Atlanta. I was there for a work project. There was also a competition called the 1986 Crystal Light National Aerobics Championship, which I competed in. So if you see the guys in blue spandex from the 80s that are in the gifts, one of those is me, and I'll give you a prize if you can figure out which one. But it shouldn't be really surprising that a budding tweaker would be excelling in a sport where you move your fast twitch muscles rapidly to music and sweat profusely in public. It was foreshadowing, but I didn't know it at the time. So while I was in Atlanta, there's a place called the Armory. I don't think it's there anymore. Yes, Armory. And I was on the dance floor, and I was getting tired, and I needed to go home. And, you know, there was this guy there that said, oh, no, wait, do this. And he put something up to my nose. I thought it was poppers, but it wasn't. And he said, just inhale. And I did, and it burnt like battery acid. And that was the first time I ever did crystal meth. And I was really pissed because, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, and there's that, I don't know if y'all know that commercial where it shows the egg, and this is your brain on drugs. Right, okay, we all know it. Okay, great. You know, I was convinced that I would no longer have children because I was doing chromosome damage to myself. Now, as a gay man back then, we couldn't have children, and we couldn't get married. So that was pretty out there. But that was the first thing because I'd been conditioned to it. So I punched this guy and said, would you give me? And then I ended up staying up and dancing for the rest of the night. You know, and so I found out that drug could help me stay awake. I could do other things later. I didn't do it for a period of time. I was just, every now and then, I'd pick it up here, I'd pick it up there. But when I got to the point where I was working in this big job and doing 72-hour turns to London to work in a data center that was there, this vice president came out one day, and I was really tired, and he said, oh, here's a productivity enhancer. And he reintroduced me to this drug, but it was in a corporate situation. So I thought, well, it can't be that bad. You know, I wasn't somebody, you know, to this day, I still haven't smoked pot. I didn't do any of those things growing up. You know, so I went straight to meth and alcohol, but being an overachiever. But, you know, we started doing these things on the planes to stay awake and in foreign countries. And, you know, I never saw myself as a drug addict or an alcoholic. You know, to me, those were the people that drank out of, you know, paper bags, and I never did that. But what I didn't realize at the time was that I was using drugs and alcohol to change the way I felt. Whether it was to change the way I felt about myself, whether it was to change the way that I felt about my situation, whether it was to change the way that I felt about anything. Because, you know, we have a saying in program that feelings aren't facts, but they aren't impactful on your life either. And so I found that by using these things that I could change the way I felt. I could be the tallest, biggest, hottest guy in the room if I did the right drugs. You know, I could find the hottest guy that, you know, I was intimidated by, and if you gave me enough alcohol and gave me enough drugs, I could go and talk to those people. And for a while, it worked. It actually worked. And I was traveling around. I was driving that BMW 750. It was a nice car, and it foreshadowed something later. I'll get to that in a minute. It was like I didn't see myself as someone who had a problem with drugs and alcohol. And that delusion, that denial, in the long run, is what kept me out for a very long period of time. The disease of alcoholism and drug addiction lies to us every day. And one of the things that I say to my sponsees is, what are the lies we tell ourselves today? I even say that with, you know, X number of years of sobriety. And for the record, I am coming up on 18 years of sobriety this August. Thank you. I originally got sober over 29 years ago, but at 8 and a half I went out, and I stayed out for a couple of years. But you know, when the drinking and using stopped being a solution, it was something that I couldn't stop. People came to me and said, "We think you have a problem," and I wouldn't stop. I couldn't stop when I lost my partner. I couldn't stop when I lost my house. I couldn't stop when I lost my job. You know, it was always your problem. It was always the stuff that you did. It was never me. And that denial continued to grow and continued to grow. And finally, somebody came up to me at work one day and they said, "Look, we think you have a problem." They said emotional problems. Well, if you've been doing drugs and alcohol every day at work, you'd have emotional problems too. But they called it emotional problems. And they said, "You need to do something about it. And if you don't, we won't have you work here anymore." So this is where I think my God shot came in. I wanted to keep my job. I didn't think I had a problem. So I walked down the hall to a guy I barely knew. I said, "You're nuts. You must be in therapy. Who do you see?" And I didn't care. I just, you know, and he goes, "I think that's a compliment, but, you know, I do have a therapist and she's really good. Here she is." And so I went and saw this lady. And, you know, I started seeing this therapist, and she ended up becoming my Eskimo because at a certain point in time she said, "I need you to listen to this. I think you have a problem with drugs and alcohol. And if you don't do something about it, I can't help you anymore." Now let's recall a moment now what a therapist is. A therapist is someone that you pay a certain amount of money to listen to you. Nobody else in the world was listening to me. And the one woman who I had to pay to listen to me was saying, "I'm not gonna listen to you." And it got my attention. So, you know, I have always prided myself on being a kind of an overachiever. And, you know, I was in all the gifted programs in school. You know, it was always something that I kind of thought was really great about the way my mind worked. I always depended on my mind. And so I'm like going, "Well, what do I need to do?" And she said, "You need to go to an AA meeting." So I went to an AA meeting, and then I went to another, I went to another, went to another. Now, the very first AA meeting, this is before CMA existed, was in the basement of a Jewish temple at Crescent Heights and Fountain in Los Angeles. And there probably were about 200 people there. And I said, "What do I do when I get there?" She goes, "You have to raise your hand and say you're a newcomer." So I raised my hand and I said I'm a newcomer and that I'm an addict and an alcoholic, and every head turned, you know. And I don't remember a whole lot about what was said in that meeting because I was still pretty out there. But what I do remember is what happened afterwards. A group of men took me by the hand and they said, "You know, we're going to go out to fellowship. Would you please come with us?" And at the time, there's this place called Hamburger Hamlet up on Sunset Boulevard. And they took me and put me in the middle of one of those red banquettes, sat on either side because I probably looked like I was ready to run out of the room. And they told me about their lives. And I looked in their lives and I saw this light in their eyes and I saw this happiness, and they had things happening in their life. And I hadn't felt that way in a very long time. And they said something really important. They said, "We'll help you come back." And it hadn't been a long time since anybody wanted me to come back. So you know what, I went back to a meeting and I went to 5 more, and I went and I talked to my therapist and she said, "You know, just keep doing this and follow direction." And you know, I know how we are when we're newcomers. We have ideas, we have solutions, we have suggestions. I was, you know, how are we gonna improve the program? And, you know, and I thought because I was this person who had been an AP student and then, you know, I thought that I was like, oh, so smart, I was very verbal about offering those suggestions, and they always said the nicest thing, "Keep coming back." I didn't know they're, you know why we do that. Anyway, so there came a day where a gentleman came up to me and he said, "Jack, I don't think you have a job, right?" "Nope." And he said, "And you're homeless?" I go, "I'm not homeless." I said, "I have a BMW." And technically I was homeless with an attitude, but, you know, and if I gave you a ride to a meeting, you should give me a housewarming gift. But anyway, he said, "You know, there's this place up on Beechwood It's called 1919 Beachwood. He said, where you can go work on your sobriety 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's like the advanced placement program for recovery. Well, that got my attention. And I said, well, sign me up. And that's how I ended up at the Van Ness Recovery House. So, yes, I see you know the Van Ness Recovery House. Yes, Kathy Watts Charm School. It's a lovely place, and they saved my life. I'm very grateful for that place. So, you know, I went there, and that's where I met Bill Coffey. So those of you who know who Bill Coffey is, he was doing the Big Book study at the group. And, you know, the Van Ness Recovery House is kind of an amazing place. They say it might be the first gay LGBT recovery house in the world. I don't keep those records, but they've been there a long time. And Kathy Watt was there 29 years ago when I was there, so, you know, she's been there a long time. And, you know, they treat anybody. I know it was the first trans outreach program because I was there when that came about. And in fact, one of my best friends, if you had told me that my best friends would be an African-American trans woman in the house, I would have said, you're crazy. Not because I have anything against trans women, but in my exposure where I've been, I didn't have any experience. But when Dee Dee spoke, I heard my feelings coming out. She was also, you know, I was older and she was older, and, you know, Dee Dee and I walked the path together, and we learned that, you know, it doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter how you identify. What matters is how you feel inside. And I learned that day, and, you know, that candle for me was for Dee Dee, because she didn't make it. And when you've been on the planet long enough, we lose people. Can I ask you guys a quick question? How many people here have less than a year of sobriety? Please raise your hand. Amazing. I'm going to talk to you guys for a minute. The service that you provide by being here helps save lives. When you talk and don't want to talk to somebody else because you think it might be stupid, wrong, or different, please don't do that. Because it's when we start shutting down and stop communicating that we become the person that candle's lit for. It's the service that you provide to those of us with time to remind us what it was like, to remind us that the program works. And when we get to see the light go on in your eyes, it makes us shine inside. So please, always be here. Always identify. Always share with your sponsor. We don't want to lose any more of you. But, you know, we did lose Dee Dee, and in that house, they have this thing called HOW. It stands for Honesty, Open-Mindedness, and Willingness. And the Van Ness House is kind of famous for a feelings thing. You know, back then, emojis did not exist. You know, they handed us a sheet of paper that had all these smiley faces on it, you know, with emojis. So I think the recovery community actually created, you know, emojis before anybody else did. And we would literally sit around the table and have to look at that list and tell people how you felt that day. And it became something we did every day. And if you had a problem or you were acting out, you would go to someone and your part of your, and not punishment, but part of your direction would be share feelings. Go share feelings. You have to share feelings every day. Side note, what's really funny is that means to people in recovery. Because you go to your first job outside and somebody says, how are you feeling? They don't want to know all that stuff. I did that my first day on the job when I got out of the Van Ness House. But anyway, you know, in the Van Ness House, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. You know, and they told us that we had the opportunity to recover. Now, I'm very observant. And listen, I'm not a woo-woo person from California, although I did bring a yoga mat and a crystal ball. So we are reinforcing stereotypes. But, you know, the idea that intelligence, which had always been my crutch, could keep me sober was smashed in the Van Ness House. Because here's what I noticed. These kids from the street, they were getting sober. The Harvard-educated Yale anesthesiologist that was there couldn't get it. And I'm thinking, there's something to be learned from that. So I got stupid really fast. You know, I'm not someone, I tend to be very practical about my approach to everything, and we'll talk about spirituality in a minute, because my spiritual approach is very practical as well. But, you know, when we talked about what you had to do to stay sober, I wasn't even sure if I was an addict or an alcoholic. You know, I hadn't gotten to that point yet. But my deal that I made with myself, and I guess my higher power at the time, but I didn't call it that, was that, look, I'm going to do everything you guys ask me to do, so if it doesn't work, I can blame you. That's not very willing, but it's enough, and it worked. So for a year, I did everything I was asked to do. So it doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how necessarily how deep your spiritual program is, although that is helpful for serenity. As long as you follow the direction of somebody else and do what they did, you'll get what they get. And I mean, that sounds so simple, but we complicate it. Oh, I'm different. I'm unique. I'm separate. You don't understand what it's like to be me. You know, my father was busted in a park. It's like we have all these things that we say make us unique and different. And so at the Van Ness house, I stayed, I transitioned. I was very blessed that I was able to be given that gift. And you know, the other thing that I was given is the desire to use was lifted. I didn't have cravings. And it's interesting how things work. They have this saying in the Van Ness house that if you point a finger at you, there's three more pointing back at me. Who knows who Carol Merrill is? Anybody? So I went to the Carol Merrill School of Pointing. I point like this. No fingers pointing back at me. That being said, there is a certain amount of learning that happens when you start connecting your experience with others. And so finding the ability to see myself not as separate, but as a part of. They said, look, you know, CMA didn't exist. They said, read the big books, substitute using instead of drinking if that works better for you. It'll still work. They said, listen for the similarities. You know, not the differences. Because I was very good at telling you all the reasons why I was not like you and you didn't understand me. You have no idea what it was like to be me. And they boiled everything down to really simple things. And so I'm very grateful that they did that because, you know, we can complicate anything. Addicts and alcoholics have very complicated minds. Our program is not that hard. It may not be easy to follow somebody else's direction, but if you think about it, we just have to follow direction. So, you know, when I got out of the Van Ness house, I sponsored people, I got jobs, you know. I had worked in tech prior to that, and they said, we want you to go get a job in retail. Now, I'd never worked in retail. I also had come into the Van Ness house with a $180,000 bill with the IRS. So my idea, mine, was to go and get a big job and try to pay that off. Kathy Watt's idea was, you're going to go to the mall and put in applications to work in retail. And, you know, I did it. I said I would do it. I did it. And it was like I put in 32 applications, and it was going back every single day and being turned down. Because, frankly, I didn't have any experience in retail, you know. Because rigorous honesty said I couldn't lie. So how am I ever going to get a job? You know, and it's interesting how higher power works. I got a phone call one day from this woman, and she said, look, she was a district manager for a retail store. And she said, I have never seen a resume like yours. It doesn't fit our industry at all. There must be a story. Tell me what it is. So I did. And she cried. She cried because her brother was in recovery. And she said, I don't have a job at the Glendale Galleria at an entry-level position, but she said, I do have one at the Century City Mall, you know, as an assistant manager, and I think you'd be perfect for it if you'll take it. So I took that job, and I worked for minimum wage. And that's how my career with the Pottery Barn, you know, started. And at minimum wage, I called it the Poverty Barn, you know. And I thought I'd really won one over Kathy Watt because, you know, she wanted me to go to the Glendale Galleria. I don't know how many of you guys know L.A., but I did not want to go to the Glendale Galleria. I either wanted to go to the Beverly Center or I wanted to go to Century City because that's where we shop. And I thought that I had really outsmarted Kathy because she said I could take the job, you know. And it was at the mall I wanted, not where she wanted me to work. Well, higher power, again, has an interesting idea. The very first time that one of my clients that I used to sell millions of dollars of software who live in Beverly Hills and shop in that mall came in, I was filled with shame. And I ran to the back stock room and I hid. And while I was back there in that dark room, I realized I can't live like this. And I started thinking about I have to find a way to be connected to truth and honesty. And I can't regret where I'm at. So the next time a client came in, she looked at me and she's like, don't I know you? And I go, you do. I used to service your account doing this. And she said, what are you doing here? So I told her the truth. And she cried because her brother was an alcoholic and he needed help. And she didn't know where to turn. So overcoming my fear in that moment, I was able to be of service to somebody else. And I had no idea that that's the way it was going to turn out. Part of walking through faith and living a faith-filled life is not knowing the results, but doing the right thing anyway. So everything in my life is not a miracle. I'm not one of those woo-woo people, but, you know, life was really good for about 8.5 years. You know, I did eventually end up getting another big job. You know, I got a big house. I made a lot of money. We took companies public. And something interesting happened. I started having excuses for not going to meetings. Oh, I'm flying to London. Oh, I'm going to be in Paris. Oh, I'm tired. You know, time zone change. I don't need to go to a meeting this week. You know, and then I started letting sponsees go. And it's an age-old story. As my work life and my identity, that I had a 4-bedroom, 3,200 square foot house underneath the observatory in Los Angeles, and that became my identity and everything associated with that. Because remember, the little insecure son that overcompensated with drugs and alcohol found the new drug and alcohol. It was called Things, you know. And so I was able to keep that for a while. But interestingly enough, when things got tough, I had all this money on paper, I had all these expenses on paper, and the dot-com boom busted. And you know what? I wasn't going to meetings. I wasn't sharing my feelings. I was doing this all by myself. So there came a certain point in time where I couldn't say I'm afraid. I couldn't say that I think that nobody will like me if I don't have these things. I couldn't say all the things that we talk about in these rooms because we support one another and we come from a place of love. I had to try to do it by myself, and that is not a good place to be. And so it became more painful to stay sober without a problem, without a program, excuse me, than it did to try and do this on my own. So I relapsed. Now, I used to say that I made a conscious decision to use. My sponsor took about a year to try to beat that out of me. She said, you don't have that power. I'm like, what do you mean? She said, that's the delusion the drug tells you. That's the delusion that the addiction tells you. You lost your sobriety when you lost your connection to your higher power. Everything past that was just leading up to this relapse. Your relapse didn't start when you put the drugs in your body. It started when you lost your connection. I didn't get that right away, but eventually I do understand it now. And so, you know, I stayed out for 3.5 years. I sold that house. I didn't have a BMW anymore, but I ended up homeless again, so I've been homeless twice. Overachiever. And, you know, can't get it right the first time, do it again. But new people, that's a joke, don't do that. But, you know, I never didn't think that I was an addict and alcoholic. I just wasn't willing to do the work. And so, you know, I would get 30 days, I would get 60 days, I would get, you know, but I could never get past that. Oh, and by the way, I was being of service during this entire time. Anybody here know the Coral Sands in Los Angeles? It's a tweaker hotel. Y'all probably have one out here too. It's a tweaker hotel. It's not anymore, but it was. You know, and I was part of the frequent guest program there. And actually my last run was 12 days with no sleep in that hotel. But because, you know, there's nothing worse than seeing a formerly sober person when you're out there partying. What, talk about a buzzkill. So, you know, I'd be walking the halls out there and like, oh, the sober guy. I go, I'm not sober anymore. You know, but what also happened is people who came in and knew that I had been sober, did not know that I wasn't anymore, said, I need help. So what I would do is I'd tell them to go back to their room and get 24 hours because I knew the rules of the Van Ness Recovery House, and I would drive them and drop them off. I wouldn't take my foot and step it on their property because they'd lose their funding. But, you know, those were the things that we did because I didn't have the solution. I just wasn't willing to follow it. And, you know, the thing that I love about the tweaker community is we are not a monolithic group. Do we have any sex tweakers here? We'll get to you in a minute. Do we have any project tweakers here? Somebody in this room knows how many parts there are in an oscillating fan, I guarantee it. Here's one for all of you guys. How many of you know why we put the remote control in the plastic baggie? There you go. These are the things that make us a community. But you know, I like to talk about collective consciousness and collective experience because these are the things that bond us together. You're bonding right now, I can see that. Here's another example, and it's not about sobriety. If I say florals for spring, you say? See, we do have things that we know that are in common. And I had that knowledge when I was out there, but I wasn't taking the action. So, you know, it was nasty the second time around. You know, we would stand around and try to figure out the age-old things about, you know, it was 4th of July one time while I was out there high, and all my tweaker friends were together. We wanted to have a barbecue, and somebody said, how do you barbecue a Tic Tac? That is the laughter of identification. They know what I'm talking about. And, you know, We thought we were really pondering very deep and spiritual things, but in reality, we were just, you know, keeping ourselves out there and entertained. But in the end, I decided I couldn't do it anymore. And when I made it a deal with God, and we'll talk about what that means to me in a minute. When I made a deal with God, I said, look, if I can't get past 60 days, I'll go back to the Van Ness house. Now, I don't know if it was the spiritual connection that I reestablished or the fear of Kathy Watt again. But, you know, I did something else that was different this time. They'd started this thing called 11-step yoga. And I thought it would be a nice, easy way to get back into the gym. So I went to this thing, you know, and higher power has a really interesting way. I don't, when I see things coming on straight on, I don't always respond the same way as when they come sideways. So I went to this thing called 11-step yoga, and I met this woman. She's like this big. I did not know she had birthed an NFL football player. And I thought she was going to be an easy yoga teacher. She was not. She was an extreme athlete. And you know, we started bringing recovery concepts into the body, and we were doing breathing, and we were doing all these different things. Now, I used to dance a long time ago, and so this was something that helped with alignment. And the idea of aligning body, mind, and spirit was really amazing. And so we get to Shavasana, which is when you lay down and you allow all the work that you've done to basically come into the body. And I literally heard a voice say, I'll never abandon you. I'll never leave you. And I'm, you know, my dad was a preacher. I went to every altar call. I went to camp. I went to, you know, prayer meeting. I went to everything. That never happened to me in a church. And I wasn't, you know, I had 60 days at the time, so I knew I wasn't hallucinating. So like a good addict and alcoholic, I thought, well, that happened then. What's going to happen next time? So I went back the next week. And this time when we got to Shavasana, I must have been crying because yoga releases a lot of stuff in the body. And the lady who was teaching was doing energy work over my heart. I don't believe in this stuff, by the way, but I will tell you it worked at that time. Because I'm practical, right? The woo-woo stuff is woo-woo until it works for me. It sounds kind of Republican, so sorry. But anyway, so, you know, in that moment, she's doing energy work over my heart, and I'm literally up in the corner of the room watching my body. And you know, in the Matrix where people go up in the air and the camera goes around 360 degrees, that happened to me in that moment. And it was just like, and then I realized I wasn't breathing, so I had to remember to breathe, and then I was back in my body. That shit never happened to me in church. So, you know, I asked this woman to be my sponsor, and I said, I don't know what just happened. And she said, you're having a spiritual awakening. And so, like a good addict and alcoholic, I came back the following week, and we were practicing partner handstand. I got kicked in the face, and my nose got broken, which taught me about what expectations can do. So, you know, she said, this is a very rare thing. It doesn't happen all the time, and you shouldn't expect it all the time. That did not stop me from expecting it all the time, and then having a resentment when it didn't happen. But we learned how to deal with that. So, you know, having that spiritual connection in a way that was completely foreign to me, it wasn't in a certain building with a certain symbol on it, you know, praying to a certain God, cracked me open spiritually. You know, and we say this thing in 11-step yoga that addicts and alcoholics in recovery aren't broken, but are broken open to their greatness. And I can embrace that, because I was kind of mad at God. You know, this is the God that, you know, broke up my family and got rid of my church, you know, got rid of everything. And I had just said to God for a very long time, I can take care of myself, you take care of the rest of people, you know. And so now all of a sudden I'm having this experience, I can't explain it, but I'm also not running from it. And so the gift of practicality, the gift of being able to be open was given to me. And so when we started the journey the second time around, I had a very different experience. When we started working the steps, I had the opportunity to, on step two, to define my higher power, and I was afraid. I wanted to follow direction because I needed to do that, but I wasn't sure what my higher power should be. So what I wrote on the paper was that I could not define in human terms what my higher power would be, because I needed something really big, because that would be limiting. But what I was sure of is that my higher power was defining me. And she said that was enough. So from that inauspicious space, I was able to start being open to spiritual experiences that were not available to me before. I could hear higher power in any building. I could hear higher power coming from any of you. I could hear higher power when I'm driving to work in any way, because I had been spiritually opened up. So some of the gifts of the program are not just the promises, but you know, it's the idea that we can evolve in our spiritual life. All the things that happened in the church took me to a point. But they didn't serve me anymore because I was a gay kid from the South that was also a drug addict and an alcoholic, and I didn't understand how anybody could love that kind of person. And I was reinforced every day by the people in my community, that community, not you guys, that we were not lovable. And so now I'm at a yoga mat, and I'm having these spiritual experiences. And so, you know, I started the path again, my second time around, being open to spirituality. And, you know, I have to tell you that we have the opportunity to create anything in our life to be higher power. Anything. I had the privilege of sponsoring somebody who was an atheist, and I thought, this is going to be hard. God's everywhere. I mean, how do I do this? And the first thing that we came up with was like, letting go and letting God. Well, he had a problem with that. And I'm like, okay. So I talked to some of my atheist friends, and I said, I don't have any experience with this. And I said, let's try something. Because the whole point of picking your own higher power is it can be anything you want as long as it's not you. So if letting go and letting God, and you don't believe in God, but what if you just let go? What if you get out of the way? Is that enough? And it was. You get the same results that we did. So the people that are, you know, really spiritually connected that get upset when you say letting go and letting God, the most important part is letting go to God. I say the most important part is letting go. It's getting you out of the way. Because here's the thing. You may not know what your higher power is, and it may change. But if you get out of the way, you're open to being a conduit for those things. So it creates this gracious space. And I do believe that all of us are acts of grace. We are sponsored into this program through the grace of the gift of somebody ahead of us that said, this is what I did. And if you do it, you can have it too. What a fucking gracious gift that is. I look around the space and I see the new people and I see the old people and I see the people that are being of service. And I think of every one of you as a fucking miracle. Sorry, fuck's a spiritual term. And, you know, the work that we do is life-saving. When you lit this candle, I had a sponsee last week overdose on fentanyl. That shit didn't exist when I was out there, you know? And it's like directly, not mixed in, like directly. That's what we're doing now. And if somebody hadn't broken down the door and he'd just lived there for less than a week and that person happened to have Narcan, he's alive by grace. He's not alive for anything you or I did. And he has a second chance. And when I look at the miracles that are in each and every one of our lives, I become very humble and very grateful. Humility is an interesting term. People talk about it in very auspicious ways. Some people talk about it positively, some people negatively. The word humility, some people think, is a part of humiliation. But it's not. It's actually about being something other than yourself. There's a story that I read when I teach a humility class that talks about a mother and a son who were standing on the back porch out in the mountains looking at stars that looked as big as chrysanthemums as they said it. And the son says to the mother, doesn't that make you feel small? And she said, no. It makes me feel grateful to be part of something so much bigger than myself. And when I look at you, that's how I feel. I am so grateful to be part of this community. The odds are stacked against every fucking one of us. I tested positive for HIV in the Van Ness house. I was supposed to die. We didn't have drugs back then. They told me at the time, and this had to be an act of faith, your disease of alcoholism will kill you before HIV will. And I will tell you, every person that tested positive in that house that's no longer with us did not die of HIV. They died of drugs and alcohol. This is the drug, the disease that kills us. So whether you have one day or a million days, you are a fucking miracle. And I salute you for that. When we move forward and talk about the ideas of how we express ourselves, I love the diversity. My higher power, as I said before, has a sense of humor. When I was in the Van Ness Recovery House, the person who taught our step study and our book study was Bill Coffey. And for those of you that know, Bill Coffey is the founder of our program. Bill Coffey's sponsor, Don Norman, went to the Van Ness Recovery House. So you can kind of almost say that CMA started in the Van Ness Recovery House, or at least was hatched by the ideas that are there. You know, and he said, come to this meeting that we're going to have. You know, and I didn't go. I didn't go. And I don't know why. And it's funny how as you get older, sometimes things kick in. And I had the flyer. I was like, why didn't I go to that meeting? Well, at 15 years, I remembered why I didn't go. Because those bitches were sketchy as hell. And I only had like a year, you know. And to tell the truth, you guys, CMA in the beginning was not a safe place. Kathy Watt would not allow those meetings to happen at the Van Ness Recovery House. Many sponsors wouldn't let their people go. There were drug deals happening in the parking lot, and people were shooting up in the bathrooms. You know, but that's because there wasn't any sobriety. The two people that had recovery were Bill Coffey and Pete Struve. You know, and Pete at the time had like 5 years, and that was like a long, we thought he was like a god, you know. But as things would have it, we persevered. Now, the reason CMA started was because in LA, if you said anything about drugs from the podium in an AA meeting, they would scream out that it was an outside issue and shout you down, and people were dying. And so Bill had this idea of creating a meeting that would be a safe place for tweakers. Now, Bill's a lovely man, and he had really great ideas, but it took other people to actually exercise and make those things happen. And Curtis Stevenson is one of them. You may or may not know that name, but Curtis helped start all of the meetings in Los Angeles. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. So we started the meetings on Monday night. At that time, all of CMA fit into the living room of a two-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles that belonged to Nina F., and we would have spaghetti suppers on Friday night and then clean it all up. You know, tweakers can cook and tweakers can clean really fast. So we would have, you know, the entire fellowship fit into one room, and, you know, we would do our spaghetti supper, you know, and then we would run up the street and go to the West Hollywood Drug and Alcohol Center and have our meeting, and it would be late at night, and we would never know who was going to walk up the steps from Santa Monica Boulevard, because that's where the hustlers were back then. That's where the street people were. I mean, anybody could come in because it was wide open. So they were really raucous and fun times. One of the things that gave me solace when I came is you guys are a little rowdy, a little loud. And, you know, when we were in L.A., y'all do a little bit of the callbacks. If you've ever been to a meeting in L.A., every single line in Are You a Tweaker has a response. And depending on, you know, and Arizona has theirs that are completely different. So if you travel CMA around the country, you know, there's callbacks and shouts are everywhere. The person who started that was Bill Coffey, because when they would say, what about alcohol? I mean, when they would say, they would talk right before they said that, he would say, what about alcohol? Or more often than not, he would say, what about hooch? Because he thought that was funny, you know. And when I had about 2 years sober, I was made the secretary of the Monday night meeting. That was the second meeting in CMA. And I was riding down with Glenn H. I was riding down to Long Beach to meet with some other CMA people. We were very self-important at that time, and, you know, just upset with all these people screaming and yelling. They couldn't, you know, we were precluding the newcomer from hearing the message. And then we got to Mark's house, and we were looking to bring him into our conversation because both of us were so self-righteously angered. And Mark said, well, I don't know. My first meeting in CMA, if I hadn't heard what about alcohol, I probably would have gone out and drink because I didn't think that mattered. In that moment, I'm patting myself on the back on this one. In that moment, I had to default because I had an opinion and he had experience. And that's one of the things that we learn here. There are a lot of opinions in recovery. Oh, do you want us to know how to say fuck you in program speak? My sponsor taught me this. He said, thank you for sharing. I'll check it with my sponsor. Or, is that your opinion or your experience? And smile angelically. We have a lot of that stuff. In my sober family, we talk about making T-shirts. I'm gonna have a T-shirt company one day, and it's gonna be called Language of the Heart Productions. And we do things, you know, whenever we have a certain turn of a phrase, you know, I want to put it on a T-shirt. And one of the ones that we had was condescension in pursuit of grace. Think about it. In the South, that's called bless your heart. But y'all probably have been either the instigator or recipient of that. And the other thing is about timers, because I keep watching my time over here. In L.A., there's this thing now where the timer goes off and they go, I acknowledge the timer. That means shut up, you know. I'm taught that anything that comes after that is just ego, right? So I just want to have a T-shirt. Imagine walking down Broadway or somewhere in New York and see a T-shirt that says, I acknowledge the timer. You would know where they were in program, right? I think that's because who else would do that? I just think it's funny. So, you know, I want to end with this and leave this with you guys. CMA, AA, it's all about hope. And if I leave you with anything, especially you new guys, I can't tell you what your life is going to be like, but I can tell you if you stay here and do the work that your life will be something that you can't imagine. Now, I teach a workshop on emotional sobriety, and it's based on the letter that Bill Wilson wrote about recovery and depression. And, you know, after you've been sober for a couple of years, you know, the steps get you clean, but it also leaves you vulnerable if you don't do any more work after that. And he even said this in the letter. So, you know, getting clean is great. And there are people that say, I work the steps every day. It's like, no, you don't. You don't. You work the principles every day, but if you don't know that, you need to go learn what the principles are. Because the principles are what keep us sober. And if you don't know what your principles are, talk to your sponsor or come see me. I'll give you a little printout with it. And when you live your life that way, it gives you something called peace and serenity. Now, in the early days, I was a tweaker. I was, like, busy. I thought keeping busy would keep you at bay, because as long as I was being really busy and doing a lot of things, you could never see how I felt inside, and you could never judge me. Hard to hit a moving target. When we get sober, we have to slow down, and then we're faced with all of those things. And so it came to a point where I needed outside help, and I got it. All of my sponsees, I have a few, they're all getting outside help. Working the steps makes you available to do all of the other things. And so if you're new tonight and you don't think you can do it, hang on, you can do it. Every person in this room has been there. And if you're older here tonight and you're having a hard time, please don't get caught in the happy, joyous, and free trap. You're allowed to have feelings. You're allowed to have life challenges. In fact, those are the people I have the most respect for. If you can stand up with 20 years and saying, I'm hurting, I honor you, because you're going to survive. You know, I have all my things that I didn't think I would be able to survive. Losing a parent, did it. Double hip replacement, did it. All of those things I've done in recovery because somebody ahead of me told me they did it. If you think tonight there's one thing that will keep you from being able to stay sober, give that information to your sponsor. Talk about it and start listening for the people who've done it, because I guarantee you you're not unique. There's somebody here who knows that. And so, that would be me. Thank you for letting me share. I'm very grateful for this program. I'm grateful for the fact that I no longer consider serenity boring, because in the beginning I thought it was boring. And, you know, we joke about I gave Rob an introduction because I went to ChatGPT, and I said, write an introduction about me, CMA, and do it in the form of Megan Thee Stallion. He's got it. It's actually really funny. But my favorite part is that I went from drama diva to serenity whore. And with that, I say goodnight. Thank you.